that somebody, they introduced me as the Oak Death Girl. And I was just like,
welcome to A Big Sur Podcast. This is episode 91, and I am Magnus Thorin, the host of the podcast. And this time I'm having a wonderful conversation with longtime community member Carrie Frangioso. Many of you know of her work, particularly with the Southern Oak Death, and that is what we talk about. We also talk about Carrie's background. We talk about the challenges that she has faced doing biological studies in the Big Sur area. We talk about her lifestyle and the fact that she lives now in a remote wild area of Big Sur at a high elevation. We're talking about invasive species on the coast. We talk about the Soberanes fire and many other things. As usual, there'll be some links in the show notes. And it was impossible for me to cut a lot of this conversation down. So it's a fairly long episode. And that is for that reason. It was such a good conversation and so many things that I didn't think would be a good thing to cut out. So I hope you enjoyed this as much as I did. Thank you for listening.
Have you ever seen it when the madrones just exude sap? I've seen it twice, and I think it's like extreme drought or something, or fire induced, I'm not really sure, but then the sap is really yummy too. But I got this job studying a mysterious pathogen that was killing tan oaks. Pathogens are really important to maintaining good forests. The flatbed truck and drove me down to Whale Point. I was giddy.
Yeah.
I mean, of course. I don't know that there's only been a couple times in my life that I could actually say like I was just shivering with laughter and excitement, you know, because they had just said this is where you're going to be for the next year.
Right.
It's like, oh my God, I have died and gone to heaven.
Yeah.
In there, you know, we obviously are having problems here on the coast with too many people, and it's getting pretty beat up.
You know?
I mean, I haven't been here that long.
Yeah.
And to see Willow Creek is crazy right now. Willow Creek would remind you of Partington in the early 2000s right now.
Wow.
It is crazy.
Wow.
Right, so we originally started studying the ecological impacts of sudden oak death, but now we're trying to just understand the fire ecology of this area.
Yeah.
Yes, one of the most fantastic things is sitting in hot water and listening to whales breathe.
Yeah.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
So if you want to just pull through the gate, I'll shut it behind us.
Okay.
And then I'll park and you'll see where I went.
Great.
What the hell?
Okay.
Hope you're not allergic to dogs.
Nope. Not at all.
Okay, good.
And so you want to put it in four-wheel drive before
I
we
did,
go.
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
This grade's a little steep.
Yeah, enter it.
Have you been out here before?
I have to admit, I was just thinking that I admit to my ignorance and inexperience. No, I have actually never been out here before. And I've kind of talked about Botcher's Gap, like as if I know everything about it.
Right, right. Well, that's Botcher's Gap. There's, if you walk to the far end of the parking lot, is a giant cliff. Giant cliff. So, because it's basically the Palo Colorado fault line.
Right.
And it just, you know, you're basically following the whole fault line. The road pretty much follows the whole fault line, but right there is just a massive cliff that drops down.
Wow.
It's pretty spectacular. It's definitely worth it. If you've never been to Bodger, you should at least check that out.
Check that out, yeah. So I've got so many questions about this out here.
Yeah, so that gate that was straight ahead of us, that leads down to the Boy Scout camp, which is now no longer the Boy Scout camp, although I always call it the Boy Scout camp, probably.
Yeah.
Now it's owned by a group called the White Stag.
Uh-huh.
And they're based out of Santa Cruz. And
what are their mission is what?
Well, it's co-ed, first of all.
Uh-huh.
But everything else sounds very much like the Boy Scouts. You know, it's a leadership sort of organization. You know, they screen the kids beforehand to make sure that they're like serious about it.
Uh-huh.
And you know, it's to, you know, build leaders of young leaders,
leadership skills. Uh-huh.
Skills. Yeah. I think that they have a lot of the same things. Like they you know, believe in, you know, teaching them about firearms and being outside and stuff. So I don't really know much about them.
Uh-huh.
I met somebody recently at the chain link fence gate, and I was like, "Who are you? I'm your neighbor."
Yeah.
You know, so they're relatively new, we'll see what happens. I know the Esalen tribe also is trying to get some parts of the land, but I don't really know all the details. I just know that the White Stag definitely has bought the camp part, the developed part of the camp.
And from here, where we are now, we can, you know, we have a little view here now. So
we're going to have a big view.
Yeah, so you can probably tell me the land for the Esalens. Can we see that?
Yeah, so we're on the Esalen tribe right now.
Okay.
They have to go over us to get to their property.
Right.
And so we kind of horseshoed through it. So we're on their property. And then
straight?
Yep, straight.
Uh-huh.
Stay straight. And then, you know, and then this is our property.
Oh my God, look at this.
It's pretty nice. It's pretty quiet up here too right now.
This is yours.
So my husband owns this. And,
right.
We've been married for, since 2016.
Right.
So yeah, this is our place. So you can just park anywhere.
Okay. I'll tell you, this is, you, like I said, you live on, first of all, on top of the world here, and in a very wild part, right? You're far from, I mean, there aren't too many neighbors out here.
No,
there are
I mean,
a few.
The Boy Scouts down in the canyon, Larry Bourne, the campground host at Botcher's, been there for 40 years.
Yeah.
And then the park district, which there's nobody who lives there.
Yeah.
And then there's two other residences behind that chain link fence gate, but they're, you know, 3 miles away.
Right, right. And neither one of you have an official position here of any kind, working for the government or for the county or anything like that.
So the Forest Service does in part fund part of my salary for the research that I do.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. But we own this property.
Yep, right.
And we live here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. And it's a nice synchronicity that you can do work here.
Oh.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, I above and beyond everything, I feel so fortunate that I have had the opportunity to do the kind of work that I do and live in the environment in which I do.
Right.
So many researchers don't have that that privilege to be able to live in, you know, for a long term in the study system in which they're dedicating their life to.
Yeah.
And so it's really only because I have to give all the credit to my boss, UC Davis, Dave Rizzo, because he, over the 17 years that I've worked for him, he has continually gotten grants to continue this research. And I've wanted to stay on, and they've wanted me to stay on, and so I'm here, you know?
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah, it is amazing.
Let's get out of the car. It's getting warm. Wow.
Yeah, we can sit. We can sit at the table.
Perfect. Yes.
Of course, I wasn't prepared to have you here, so I didn't.
Oh, I know. That's terrible.
Yeah. I mean, this part. Yeah. You know, this part I tidied for you.
Yes.
But yeah. So that's the ventana window.
Yep.
You know, ventana double cone to the left.
Yep.
This is Pico Blanco. And then we're seeing...
Oh, this is the Pico Blanco.
That's
from
Pico
behind.
Blanco from
wow,
the other side.
Right. Of course, I've seen that before, but that's so close. From
so
here.
Different.
Yeah.
From the highway side.
Right.
Yeah, really, really different shape and vegetation. And
it's all green, kind of.
Yeah, there's more trees, you know, north facing.
Yep.
So, and that's Cabeza Prieta, which leads to Mount Manuel. So we, and the lighthouse is pretty much due west of us right now.
Yep.
So if you look on a map, you know, Palo Colorado heads south, pretty much south, southeast a little bit.
Mm-hmm,
and so we're about 3 miles as the crow flies due west of the Pointzer Lighthouse.
Right, right.
Which affords us a little bit of cell reception.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Which is...
Nice. Nice. Let me, you know, have to make sure that we get everything. Just a second.
Can I get you something to drink?
Some water would be great.
Yeah. I also have homemade kombucha.
Well, if you have that, it'd be fun too, maybe. Yeah. So your sleeping area is not here.
Not here. Yeah. Yeah, it's over there.
Uh-huh.
Yep.
Right.
We that's kind of a new. That's kind of new for us right now. It's it's an insulated refrigerated container.
Uh-huh.
So it's crazy, Magnus. I mean, it's insulated.
Right.
It's
but I mean, that's a good thing, right?
I've never lived in a house in Big Sur that's been insulated.
Insulated, right.
Never.
No.
It's crazy. Uh-huh. I mean, the amount of fire that it takes to be warm is...
like nothing.
It's like nothing.
Right.
It's
you
get,
you
bizarre.
Have to walk into the room and warm it up with your own body heat.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so nice.
Mm-hmm.
It really, really is. Like, it's really, really nice. And yeah, it's still a novelty.
So before we start unraveling the mystery of all of your activities, since we're sitting here now, and what strikes me at this very moment is, of course, the Soberanes fire.
Oh.
Just tell me what happened with you personally.
The Soberanes fire, you went the long or the short.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, the most salient point, the points that, well, you know, the most, what comes to mind really is the one I want to hear.
We lost everything.
Oh.
That
was here?
No, actually our house was down there.
Okay.
Right after the fire, we needed a place to be.
Right.
And so we built this. And that's what we've been living in ever since.
Right.
Is this dome. So, super, super intense. You know, we, you know, we had done a lot of preparation and, but on the day that it got here, we were looking at it, and it was 10:30 at night, and we're looking at it, you know, over past Long Ridge, and all of a sudden I'm looking around, and there's just sparks all around us, embers flying all around us, and I look over the edge, and there had been, you know, it was 2.5 miles from the fire,
right,
and so, but the winds were 40 miles an hour,
yeah.
And at that point, we were like, we're out of here.
Yeah.
Because we had talked to Jeff Quasney that day, and Jeff said, we're coming up here to work on your on this line, because this is a 2008 Bight Basin Complex fire line
right.
that goes all along this ridge
yep.
And right through this property.
Yeah.
And they wanted to reopen it.
Right.
And but at that point, at 10:30 at night, nobody's here. And so that was it. We drove out yeah. with, you know, fire on both sides of us, and we got our vehicles out. I got my computers out. We got all the animals out.
And you felt like this was at the very tail end of the opportunity to do that.
Oh, yeah. Once
had you waited a lot longer, this you wouldn't have been
No, that was it. I mean, we knew that was it because, I mean, the fire was right below us.
Right.
And the winds and just, you know, I mean, it basically was blowing it right towards us. There was no way.
Right.
I mean, our structures were built, I don't know, maybe in the 50s, and they were all redwoods and termites holding hands. I mean, they were all whole, you know.
Were there a lot of things that you of your own creative work, either you or your husband's creative work, that was lost?
Oh, there's lots of things that was lost, you know, good and bad.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, the good is that, like, there's a lot of things in there that, you know, people that we store. And
the spring cleaning.
Yeah. And, you know, even things that, you know, safe keeps, mm-hmm. you know, yep. memorabilia, stuff like that. I would never have thrown it away. And so that is good, but there's so much that we lost, you know, so much.
Yeah. And things that you still get reminded of, perhaps.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because that's the same story you hear from people.
Yeah. Yeah. My really good friend, one of my first friends, actually my first friend in Big Sur, was Rocky and Jerry Baird.
Uh-huh.
And for years, I'd hang out with Jerry, and she'd tell me, I had this, and, oh, but that was before the fire, oh, burned in the fire. And, like, it almost was a joke, right?
Because,
oh, yeah, and let me guess, like, it burned in the fire. And so now, you know, and she told me that. She's like, you cannot understand what it's like to lose everything in a fire unless you go through it.
Right.
And she's right. She's absolutely right. I mean, yeah, it's hard. But, I mean, here we are.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's now it's 8 years coming up mm-hmm. in this July. And we have amassed a month, a whole mountain of stuff.
Yes.
You know?
Already.
Yeah. Like, really fast. I mean, in a lot of generosity from a lot of different people. I mean, especially CABS, you know, helped mm-hmm. us with our water system, you know, like the county, even the government helping, like, you know, deferring taxes until everything that you have is basically paid back.
Right.
You know, 'cause we didn't have insurance. You can't get insurance. Yeah, we're too far from anything.
I saw the utilities that had been put in the road.
Yeah.
What are those? And I saw that the land had slid off, and it seemed like there had been some challenges.
Yeah. That's the phone line.
That's the phone line.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's no longer working at this point.
It works to Joe Paulo.
Okay.
But that's like them, like, piecing it together with electrical tape and stuff. But we used to have a landline up here.
Mm-hmm.
When I first moved up here in 2009, we had a landline, and it was just hell trying to keep that thing going.
Right.
You know, it's like you're going through a rodent metropolis to get to those hot to the Paulo, and it's just like. Once we figured out, like, how to capture the cell service, we had a booster and stuff like that. It was a game changer. Total game changer. And satellite internet, mm-hmm, you know. Mm-hmm. So now we have satellite.
Now internet. You have Elon Musk.
Yeah. We do. We have Starlink, and it's. I mean, all through the pandemic, I was having to drive down to the highway.
Right.
And sit in my car.
Oh, God. Yeah.
And, you know, rig up my battery to my laptop, because if my meeting was more mm-hmm, than an mm-hmm. hour, my laptop, you know, it was just like, I hit a couple of low points down mm-hmm, there, you mm-hmm. know, like where leading a meeting or whatever it may be.
Yeah.
And just, you know, sitting at night with the Lucy light illuminating me, you know, those little solar lights in my car.
Yeah.
It was just, you know, got to the point where it was embarrassing.
Not fun anymore.
No, and not professional.
Right.
You know? I mean, I introduce myself to somebody, it's like, what do they think of me, you know? I think a lot of people are like, who is this person, you know? So, it's been revolutionary to have fast internet.
Another thing that strikes me here is we're high up now, What are the, what's...
Oh, we're at 2,500 feet here.
Of course, look around.
Yeah.
But, so, from here, where is the nearest, I suppose the Botcher's Gap is right here. So there are trails, some hiking trails.
Were trails,
right. Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious about that. I mean, it's Soberanes. There are other things that have happened. What about the public's access around this area where you are here?
Well, so right after the Soberanes fire, before the winters came, they put that chain link fence gate up at the hoist. Mm-hmm. They had no intention of maintaining these last 4 miles of road.
Right, right.
And so they haven't up until last year. Mm-hmm. And so it was basically us, the Boy Scouts, mm-hmm. And the people at Jalpalo, mm-hmm. that kept this road open. And you know, a couple of years, 2 years ago, I believe, they finally cleared out the culvert.
Okay.
And so...
But you've been able to get in and out.
Yeah.
With some struggle.
Yeah. I mean, the Patch Brothers did that that first big slip when you go around the corner.
Yep.
They put, there's some like beams, wooden beams under there.
Right.
You know, that was just them just doing it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so I don't know what the situation is with the road, you know. It seems like they're taking a much greater interest. I can't believe what they did this year. And I don't know if it has something to do with the Boy Scouts selling. I know the Boy Scouts have been pushing the county,
right,
to because they haven't been able to open. And that's what they say. That's part of the reason that's why they have to sell.
Yeah.
Is because they can't bring the public in here.
Right.
So, you know, that's the way it is. You know, we're not... However it is, you know, of course we're fine with it right now, mm-hmm. But we can still get through.
Yeah, yeah. And in your experience living here, you haven't had too many lost hikers coming up and wondering where they are.
No, we have
a few.
Yeah, we have. Whenever I see a hiker pass the gate,
right,
you know, I stop.
Right.
Because they don't know.
Right.
They don't know. There's no trails. I mean, I have to go out there for my work, you know, but I've been going out there for 17 years.
Right.
And I get lost now. You know, like there really are no trails.
Right.
And so, you know, you see people walking down Palo and they're got their backpack and they got shorts on and you're like, do you know what you're getting into?
So this thing of you getting lost is because of post-fire.
No. Oh. Carnage.
Vegetation, complete change of landscape. Yeah.
Total, complete. And the trail's not there. You know, little bits of it are there and you can follow it and stuff. I mean, I say I get lost, but I mean, I'm not like to the point where I need rescue or anything, but like, you know, I'm not following the trail anymore.
Right, right. No, you know? I had an experience myself, and I'm not at all the kind of hiker you are, but, or certainly not now, but I wasn't even in the past. But I got lost very close to my home.
Yeah.
And I felt so embarrassed. And I literally had a moment when I thought, I need to call for help because I was stuck
in a
dramatic fashion. And it worked out, but it was very scary at one moment there. And again, I felt embarrassed. And then I called Steve Harper, who you know is a hiker and knows the backcountry really well.
Yeah.
And he made me feel so much better because he said, no, I know.
Yeah.
I get lost too.
Yeah.
Because of the complete change.
Complete change.
Yeah.
All of your landmarks are gone.
Right.
You know.
Overgrown.
So overgrown. I mean, it's just... it's gotten a lot harder,
you know,
and I just gave the rest of our group, our research group, an update yesterday on last year's season. And we had like the lowest number of plots, you know, resurveyed last year. Uh-huh. And in part, it's because of access issues.
Right.
I mean, the other part is that, you know, more than half of the plots have come back in C. enopus. And so... we measure C. enopus.
Mm-hmm.
And so you typically, you know, we would do a plot a day.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes a plot might take 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
We had a plot this year take us 5 days.
Mm-hmm. We're going to get back to this, but just now, explain to me, what does it mean, a plot? How is that defined? And you're obviously doing, like, you're doing yearly or bi-yearly or something like that. You revisit a plot to see the vegetation change. Talk to me about that.
So the 280 plots were set up in 2006 and 2007. So they were big field seasons. They were six-month-long field seasons. Mm-hmm. And they are from Carmel Valley all the way to San Capoforo. So all along the coastal slope, you know, we go somewhat in higher elevation, but our focus really was the habitat where we might find sudden oak death. Mm-hmm. So originally they were set up to monitor the ecological effects of sudden oak death. Mm-hmm. Then in 2008, we were taking a year off, and then we had the Basin Complex fire. So we had a natural born experiment at that point.
Right.
So we did this post-fire burn survey where we went to as many plots as we could that had just recently burned before the rains came. By far the most dangerous field season I have ever had. Mm-hmm. It was crazy out there. And then ever since then, we have been returning to a subset of those plots. I actually just totaled them. We have done 596 plots that we have resurveyed. Since 2007.
Wow.
Yeah. So.
No, wait. Okay. So when you say we.
Yeah.
Who are they? We.
I'm an employee of the plant pathology department at UC Davis, Dave Rizzo's lab. And then through the 17 years, we've had multiple different PhD and master students come in and out of the lab. One of which also did his postdoc with us and is now a professor down at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. My boss is getting ready to retire, and so now I am working with him. Wow. So I work for both UC Davis and Cal Poly. Mm-hmm. But some of those other postdocs have also moved on. So this right now where it stands, this project is a collaboration between UC Davis still, Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, Boise State in Idaho, the University of Georgia at Athens, and North Carolina State University.
Wow.
So
the umbrella for that is plant pathology.
No, everybody has their own forte. Allison Simler at Boise State has really done more of the ecological, more of the ecology, looking at seedlings and looking at the community dynamics of different tree species and the structure. Nina Wurzberger is at University of Georgia, and she's most interested in ceanothus and the role of nitrogen fixation and soil turnover.
I see. So there are lots of sort of sub-disciplines that are utilizing the same network of plots.
Yes.
And you share information and you share resources.
Yeah. We have a landscape ecologist who focuses mostly on GIS. That's in North Carolina.
Right.
And then Richard Cobb down at Cal Poly. He, too, is really interested in soils and fuels. Mm-hmm. And so he also does a lot of management. And I think I mentioned that, too, that so he and I are working on a couple of different management projects around the state. Mm-hmm. Their goals are really to see how much management do you need to do to sequester more carbon, and can you do management to prevent disease, or what does it take to restore areas that have had massive amounts of disease? Mm-hmm. So there's three different projects that we're working on with that. And this year we're taking a break from Big Sur, which I'm very happy about because it's really hard.
What is really hard?
Working in Big Sur.
Okay. Period.
Yeah, period.
You mean it's too steep?
Everything, Magnus. Yeah. I mean, between access, between the ceanothus, between the steep plots, you know, the everything. If it's not one thing, it's another. If it's not poison oak, then it's the flies. Or if it's not that, then it's the fuels. If it's not that, then it's the ceanothus. If it's not that, it's the tan oak fuzz. I mean, it goes on and on. It's the heat. It's really hard.
Yeah,
it's
really
hard. And I'm working mainly with undergraduates, and they are totally green. They've never done field work before.
Right, right.
And I go overboard to encourage them that this is not what all field work is like, you know, right. And to really kind of give them the confidence that, because they come and they don't think they can do this.
Right.
You know, and then like, and then, but I tell them, you guys, you're going to be able to do more than you think, you know, and they're, you know, they'll say like, geez, Gary, that was hard. And I'll say, but look, you did it. I'm telling you guys.
So give me an example of what that would have been for these undergraduates. And you took them out in the field and then they said to you, my God, that was hard. What is it? What was it that was so hard? And what was your ambition that day, let's say?
Oh, just to go back to a plot, you know. So again, the plots are 500 meters squared. Mm-hmm. So they have, there are 25 meter radius circle.
Yep.
And in that plot, we measure all the trees.
Sorry, but what are you measuring?
We're measuring what we call the diameter at breast height.
Uh-huh.
We measure the health of them, their canopy position, whether or not they're resprouting. And then we also look for disease symptoms on each individual.
Do you also photograph?
We photograph, yep, from the center in the cardinal directions and repeat them each survey. We document all of the plant species in the plot and then, you know, herbaceous as well. And we give them a cover class. Mm-hmm. How much do we have of, you know, honeysuckle or whatever it may be.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're also doing these brown transects, which everybody hates. And they're basically a 1970 protocol of how to measure fuels on the landscape.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're measuring sticks and twigs and logs. And then we're also collecting soil for nutrient analysis.
Right.
So that's like most of what we do in a plot.
So again, when the kids came home from that day of work,
from that day.
Let's say, I mean, just, you know, was it just the sun? Was it the, you're such a stern boss or?
No. I mean, I try. Well, I can't speak to that, right? You know, last year I had, before the field season last year, I had a couple of older technicians who spent a number of seasons with me confide in me that I needed to lay off a little bit, that I needed to go a little bit easier on people and that maybe it would be better.
You're ambitious. You're a little too ambitious.
A little too ambitious. So I took it to heart and I really tried this year, but you know, you got to get the work done. You know what I mean? That's the bottom line.
Yeah.
But you know, like, sometimes just getting to the plot,
yes.
You know, I mean, maybe it doesn't, it's like, oh, it's only, you know, 500 meters from, a trail or a road, but 500 meters through some of this stuff is not easy.
Right.
And now after this year, after more down trees and stuff, you know, it's like the vegetation and the trees and climbing over things and you're trying to, you know, it's like, I know a lot of these plots really, really well by now. Some of them I've been back to 8 times. And so, you know, it's always interesting to me to see the landscape change and to see the individual trees change. And oftentimes it's sad, you know, like everything has changed so much.
You create these baselines, but they are still very short in terms of time.
Oh, ultimately. Human perspective.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
But, you know, these trees are, you know, some of them are pretty old. And to see, you know, see a giant crater in the ground from like this giant tree. It's like one fire. Okay. You know, one fire, it's like, oh, it can handle it. It starts resprouting stuff. But when you had, you know, that this double burn scenario that where it burned in 2008 and then burned just 8 years later.
Yeah.
I thought 2008 was transformative, but that double burn area is just insane.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a major, major loss of trees.
Mm-hmm.
Across the board.
You know, Carrie, I want to get back to that and to back to more to the studies and the challenges with those and the results and those kinds of questions. But before that, before we get there, I want to ask you your personal story just real quick. When did you and I first meet? How long ago did you come to be? I mean, I remember it's quite a while ago.
So I first came to Big Sur in 2001.
Okay.
And I worked for the Wildlife Conservation Society at that time. I was trying to quantify acorn production in Tan Oak Forest.
Ah.
that was a 5-year-long project that abruptly ended due to funding. Yep. But I believe that we hosted a meeting at the Henry Miller Library years ago.
Yeah.
And, you know, just to disseminate our information, to try to educate people about sudden oak death at the time, what we knew so far.
Had just begun, kind of?
Well, I mean, so it was first identified in the summer of 2000.
Yep.
You know, it was relatively still new. I mean, mm-hmm. there's still a lot of unanswered questions, but we know a lot more now.
Yeah. Before that, where did you come from?
I was born and raised in Massachusetts.
Uh-huh.
And after college, I bounced around to lots of different field jobs.
I did
bird work. I did lake work. I worked with bees. I've worked with limnology, the study of, you know, lakes and nutrients. I did a whole bunch of different things.
Yeah.
And, you know, I got to the point where I was like, I just want to put my toothbrush somewhere, you know, like,
sure.
Get out. I want to move out of this bag, you know. Yeah. And it's funny because, like, you know, people always ask and, you know, how'd you get into this and whatnot? And I remember in college, you know, somebody asking me like, well, if you could choose. And I've always been interested in working on a long-term ecological monitoring plot.
Yeah.
Like, and so here I am. I mean, I feel so lucky
to
have that opportunity.
I was going to ask you this a second ago. Are you still pursuing any kind of academic?
No.
That's
right
done.
Now, no. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so I was working in a chemistry lab extracting polyhydrocarbons in Boston and, you know, just sending out my application everywhere like I would normally do during the field season. And I got this job studying a mysterious pathogen that was killing tan oaks. And that was in the summer of 2000.
Okay. So who was it that hired you for that? Sorry, I missed that.
That was the Wildlife Conservation Society, which was kind of out of their realm of things, you know, definitely like this pathogen and in these trees. But so...
How much of a... Because I don't recall, of course, exactly when this happened. You will recall or can recall. How much of a community discussion, how much of a sense of course not panic, but sense of deep concern was it, and when did that start?
Oh yeah, I think there was a huge huge ruckus about it in 2000.
Yeah.
You know, there were people in Marin in the 90s who were raising the alarm, and there was just so many people that eventually they were like, okay, we've got to figure this out.
Yeah.
And so it was really the summer of 2000 that everybody, all kinds of people were hitting the ground trying to figure it out. And like I said, that's when it was identified by my boss was one of the people to identify the species.
And that identification has proven to be true, to carry on, so to speak.
It's an individual. It's an oomycete, so it's a water mold. It's, you know, a lot of people. It behaves much like a fungus, except for that it can swim through water.
Mm-hmm.
Really hard thing to study.
Yeah.
But it's Phytophthora ramorum. Phytophthoras are not new to science. A Phytophthora caused the Irish potato famine. So. Interestingly, in 2004, you know, this is back in the day when they weren't really mapping the genome of things and mapping the DNA. They picked one, it was one of five organisms of which they were to map the genome of, including tobacco and cotton and corn and soybean and then Phytophthora ramorum.
Wow.
Because the government has and continues to this day realizes the potential of a Phytophthora like this causing widespread destruction.
Yes. And then the Phytophthora, this is not a, does it operate, the term for it, I'm sure it might be a bit wrong, but it's not like it's mutating, or is it? Or, I mean, because it can obviously affect all kinds of different things other than a tan oak, let's say.
Yes, yes. It does get on almost everything in our forest, but it doesn't necessarily kill everything in our forest. It, you know, there's only a few things that it actually kills. But Phytophthora means plant killer.
Mm-hmm.
And what we've had in California, for instance, is a clone of itself. Mm-hmm. I mean, the genetics, I'm not a geneticist, but I am fascinated by what we are learning from genetics.
Right.
To see, you can see the actual introduction points of, and then you can see that the fine mutations as it continues to clone itself. Mm-hmm. However, there are, so there's two mating types. They don't really call it male and female, but there are two mating types. And just recently, the European strain, because it is in Europe too, the European strain of the opposite mating type was found in Del Norte County. Nobody really knows what will happen if that strain, it's called the EU1 strain, and the NA1, which is here in California, what will happen if they combine. The EU1 strain up in Del Norte County is more aggressive, especially towards conifers. Mm-hmm. So as you can imagine, the timber industry is everybody's kind of freaking out about that.
Of course.
So each year I host a sudden oak death blitz where we invite the community to come out. We educate them about what sudden oak death is, and we teach them how to identify symptoms. Mm-hmm. And then we give them sampling packets and we say, go sample wherever you want.
Yeah.
And it happens all around the state. I think there's 22 locations that it happens all around. It's a huge citizen science project. Mm-hmm. And it's run by UC Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
And UC Berkeley is now actually identifying which strain of all of those samples that they get are, mm-hmm. Mainly because everybody's freaked out about this EU1 being here.
Possibly,
now.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
but so far, so good.
It was just found last year.
Yeah.
So,
right.
And they've done a huge management effort to like try to eradicate it, but eradication has not worked anywhere yet. So,
and the methods for eradication have been multiple, various methods.
Yeah, yeah. Mostly it's like clear cutting and burning everything on site
and
using like lots of herbicide.
Yeah.
So, up in Oregon and Washington, they have less strict rules. Oftentimes they do it on timber mm-hmm. property. And so they are a lot more aggressive.
Yeah.
Obviously that would not necessarily happen here in California, but even still, like even with their really aggressive techniques, it's definitely slowed the spread.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But it has not eradicated it.
Right.
It's definitely, definitely slowed the spread.
Do we have any kind of historical record? I mean, there's an historical record localized. It is also sort of an international record. I mean, it can become a very big, but these pathogens or this particular pathogen, is there an historical record?
No, I mean, that's one of the challenges working with it, right? There's no archaeological record.
Right.
You can go back in herbarium samples, but typically people wouldn't take herbarium samples that have spots on them,
Right.
So there's not. I mean, you can look at the genetics.
Yeah.
I think it was in 2021, they actually found the origin of Phytophthora ramorum, which is in
this particular one.
Specifically Phytophthora ramorum. And to find the native range, you have to have both mating types there, mm-hmm. and you have to have genetic diversity. And so they did find that. And that was in the forests of northern Vietnam along the China border. At elevations about 5,000 feet, the forests there have almost all the same species that we do. Not species, but of the same family.
Right.
So they have the relatives of tan oak. They have quercus. They have laurels. They have lots of ericaceous, madrone, rhododendron. So they have it there, but it doesn't cause widespread disease because it's native there. Right. So what we have here is...
There's a resistance, you mean,
in
the plant community.
Yes.
Yeah.
Just like, I mean, we have a ton of pathogens that are native here, and
right.
they kill a tree here and there. It keeps the forest healthy.
Yeah.
Pathogens are really important to maintaining good forests.
Mm-hmm.
But when these trees can't recognize it as being a pathogen, they don't react in time.
Mm.
So they don't fight it off until it's too late.
Yeah. So it's again admission of my own lack of curiosity, I guess, when it comes to my immediate environment. I'm just looking at what has happened. We spoke of it just earlier about how difficult it now is to even enter into some of the areas that I used to go down to the creek. Now it's just a cacophony of overgrown and fallen trees and so on. I'm talking about Partington, North Middle and South Fork.
Yeah.
How? And you, I know you were there, and you did have. Did you have a plot there?
I have multiple plots up there.
Okay.
Yeah.
So then you can tell me, even though I live there, I should know, but I don't. But I do know when I think back on going down to the North Fork, to the creek bed, being welcomed by a creek, ferns, moss. I'm serious.
Yes, I know.
And rocks in this beautiful water.
Yeah.
And you could sit down there and have the most extraordinary moment of communing with nature, let's say. And the sun would shine through the canopy of oaks, tan oaks, and redwoods. And now those tan oaks are gone.
Yeah. No, I mean, they're re-sprouting.
Yep.
It's a mess. It's a mess.
They are everywhere. Re-sprouting. This is hopeful.
So when you look in other areas that have had the pathogen longer or are in better habitat for the pathogen, I'm thinking specifically like closer down to the coast, even in Marin, those areas have had the pathogen longer. The trees have, it hasn't burned. So the trees fall down, they decompose, and then they resprout. Once the resprouts get to be a certain size, then the pathogen finds them again. And then like the whole cycle starts all over again. And you wind up having, down logs, resprouting trees that are dead standing with their leaves on them. And then they're starting to die, but they're still trying to resprout. One of our questions, one of the things we don't know is, well, how long can they do that for?
Right.
You can look to other examples like the chestnut, the American chestnut on the East Coast. And, that was affected by the chestnut blight. And at the time, people were like, all the chestnuts are going to die. So a lot of people harvested the chestnuts. But even to this day, you can go out and find resprouts in the forest. Mm. But once they get to be big enough, the pathogen comes and finds them and kills them. So,
and then over time, one would expect that they would develop some sort of resistance if several generations.
So that's kind of what's happening with Monterey pine and pitch canker, right?
Yep.
So the next generation, the young seedlings are brought into this environment in which the pathogen is present. And so they are able to then recognize it as they grow, as this is something bad that I need to fight off. Mm-hmm. And it's totally possible that may happen. We have, UC Berkeley specifically has been doing resistance trials. They collected tens of thousands of acorns and reared them and then subjected them to the pathogen to see if they can find any resistance. Very, very little to no resistant in tan oak, but with the true oaks there are. Some individual oaks have been living with the pathogen for a really long time.
Right.
So the true oaks, the Quercus, the coast live oak, the shrieve oak, canyon live oak, and black oak, they all have the possibility of surviving.
They're doing better.
They have the more potential.
Right.
But tan oaks.
Yeah. As far as the acorn production, because it's an interesting thing considering that now we're getting more and more research around the native populations, and I'm thinking they may have gone through feast and famine when it comes to in their history.
For sure, for acorns. I mean, we know that the true oaks they massed, meaning that like some years they just have a ton of acorns, and then other years they don't have any.
Right.
And most of that, from everything that I know about that, is mainly to do with the spring weather. Mm-hmm. When the flowers are out, like if it rains and it has a big storm, they'll knock all the flowers off. So very few are pollinated to make acorns. Mm-hmm. But with tan oaks, they are the most consistent producer. Mm-hmm. Over every year they have something.
Yep.
They can mast and they can have a big bumper crop, but they don't ever have total crop failure.
Steady.
Yeah. So the loss of tan oak really, especially in the redwood forest.
Had this been in 1450, let's say, or year 1300, it could have been close to a catastrophe for the native population.
I would imagine that. Mm. You can talk about native peoples, but. Mm. our native animals are also very much right. dependent. As we have acorn woodpeckers all over here, the dusky-footed woodpecker, dusky-footed wood rat.
Yeah.
I mean, they cache acorns. Deer populations have also been closely tied with big acorn ears, allowing them to survive better.
Yeah.
So there's a number of species.
Trickling effect.
Trickling down, absolutely, especially with the wood rat, you know, being at the bottom and so many different things eating it, you know. So, actually, I'm actually working on a talk about this is good for me because so I'm going to give a talk at the California Wildlife Day at Palo Corona this Sunday. They've had really good success with people being there. So they've asked me to talk about specifically about like the wildlife effects, which is something I haven't really talked about. In a long time, I've been talking a lot about the fire effects, but this is, so yeah, this is good. It's a cascading effect down.
These plots, for instance, they are entirely focusing on plants. So now when we talk about the wildlife, are you studying populations of wildlife as well?
No, because
that they fluctuate down in, like we just talked about, with these kinds of phenomena in the landscape.
It's interesting because I don't really, in the beginning days of Sudden Oak Death, there were people who were very much focused on the wildlife component, but the funding didn't go that way.
Right.
I think it was important to try to understand what the pathogen is doing. More and more there's people who are really concerned about it. There's so many different things that are happening now. I mean, even our own research, disease is actually taking a back seat to fire effects, right? So we originally started studying the ecological impacts of Sudden Oak Death, but now we're trying to just understand the fire ecology of this area.
Yeah.
There is very little to no research done on Mediterranean ecosystem fire ecology.
Right.
Most all of the fire ecological research is in conifers.
Uh-huh.
And so now, most of California lives in this ecosystem. And we know so little about how they survive or how well they do with fire. So we're really learning a lot right now.
Right. And when you say they in that context, you mean flora and fauna?
Yeah, of course.
So how much of that have you done so far as fire ecology? It's on the agenda, kind of. Obviously, it is in this environment. And we've had these large fires.
Yeah.
It's three of them very recently.
Mm-hmm.
So it's on people's minds. So how much of that have you done so far?
Well, I mean, there's things that we learned. There's things we've learned. We've learned that, in areas where there is disease and it burned, depending upon the stage of the disease, right? So, the disease comes in, it kills the tree, and then you have a standing dead tree with the leaves still on it. Eventually that tree falls down and, drops a bunch of branches, and then eventually the whole tree falls down. But in the meantime, other trees are dying. And then over a long period of time, all those tan oaks would, say, be on the ground, and you'd have decomposition happening and whatnot, and maybe don't have any standing dead trees with leaves still on them. Mm-hmm. Depending upon the stage of the disease, it really dictated the severity of the fire. So in that mid stage where you've got it all, where you've got standing dead with leaves and stuff on the ground, redwoods in particular, especially of an intermediate size, not the really big guys, not the really little guys, but those middle size class redwoods were twice as likely to die in areas with disease. So that was one of the things. We've also learned that in areas with Sudden Oak Death, with more fuels on the ground, that the soil burns a lot more severe. And so a lot more nitrogen and phosphorus are volatilized and are evaporated into the atmosphere. It's just gone. And that's kind of a path that we're going to continue researching on this trend. Specifically because of the role of ceanothus, how long does it take to fix nitrogen?
Mm-hmm.
How long does it take for a ceanothus to do it? In other systems, sometimes it takes up to 60 years.
Yeah.
I almost lost it when I heard that, Mike, 60 years?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it would be a major miracle if we didn't have another fire in 60 years.
Right.
So
explain that, what you just said, that the fixation of nitrogen in the ceanotus plant takes. Explain to me what you exactly what you mean by
how
that.
How it does it?
Yeah. No, and also the, what the ramifications are. What your you almost lost it. You said meaning that you had hoped that something else would be the case.
Well, I mean, so I think that when a less severe fire goes through, a lot of nutrients would be deposited, would be recycled into the earth.
Right.
But when you have a very severe fire and you have longer residence time where the fire stays in one place,
high combustion temperature,
longer time in one spot, a lot of those nutrients get volatilized away.
Right.
And so a plant like ceanothus thrives in areas with low nitrogen. So they are nitrogen fixers. They are able to take advantage of that situation by establishing first and sinking their roots. And they have these symbiotic bacteria in these nodules that live on, I don't know if you'd call it living, but that exist on their roots.
Yep.
And those bacteria allow ceanothus to take atmospheric nitrogen and fix it into a usable form and put it back into the soil.
Kind of like cover crops.
It's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
It's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
It's a massive cover crop, right?
Yeah.
That does it for a very, very, very long time.
Yeah.
We don't really know. You know, I've definitely read that our species here can last anywhere between 35 and 45 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen that out on the forest as well. I don't know that our species have been studied explicitly to say that's exactly how long they live.
Yeah.
But as they do that, they basically drop their leaves, and then as the leaves decompose, and they can put those nutrients back into the ground, which would then allow the tree species to access that nitrogen, which they absolutely need to grow.
Right. So that's a symbiotic scenario. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So the ceanothus is very important.
Yes.
You know, very important. As much as we can't stand it because it makes an impenetrable wall. However, though, when you go into like the area you were talking about, into Partington, that last burned in 2008, those ceanothus are so big now, you can walk around underneath them.
Right.
It's a forest under there. I mean,
a nice, tight canopy.
Oh, very tight canopy. But I mean, at least you can see.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I remember this one time we were sitting in a plot that had ceanothus. I think it was only, it's probably only like 4 years old. Mm-hmm. So dog hair. Right, you know, and talking with actually Allison, the woman at Boise State, she was like, geez, you know, we're talking about that nobody studies the fire ecology. She's like, I don't understand why nobody. I'm like, Allison, you're 5 feet away from me, and I can't see you. That's why people don't study these ecosystems. I mean, look at us. You know, we're crawling around on our hands and knees. We got hoods on, so all this stuff doesn't fall down our thing, our jackets. We have masks on because it's all dusty, know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, that's why, because it's really hard.
Yeah.
It's really hard. So ceanothus absolutely plays a vital role. And that's something that, like I said, we are very much focused on, which is heartening to me because I spent a lot of time measuring ceanothus.
Yeah. You know, I have a quick experience that I had way back in the 90s. Actually, late 80s, we used to ride horses quite a bit up on the Coast Ridge Road, back in Cold Springs and over there. And at one point, I'm coming on the road, you know, and there's this deer jumps across the road and disappears on the hillside, downhill from the edge there. And as I rode by, I looked down, and it's a dense thicket of ceanothus.
Oh, right.
And I thought, damn, I wish I'd had a camera just to see how did that deer navigate
in there. Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Anyway, just remarkable.
Yeah. Some of the other things that we've learned too is that in areas with disease that have burned twice, fewer trees survive.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, that whether or not that's a bad thing remains to be seen.
Yeah.
You know, the trees that do survive the fire and disease basically resprout way more than trees that when that only burned once, say. When there's fewer trees, they have more resources, right? This is like general silviculture.
Yep.
Fewer trees, they have more resources to grow, yep. and essentially sequester carbon. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of, it's kind of a weird twist, but also like a positive, mm-hmm. one positive mm-hmm. of it.
I was just going to ask that actually, because it has to do with the sequestering of carbon.
Yeah.
Ultimately. Yeah. So talk about that for a minute, because that's something that's fairly, it's not new, but it has been more part of our discussion when it comes to our contemporary ecology.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a buzzword right now, uh-huh, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, and it's really important, you know, that's kind of the name of the game is like, how do we get all this carbon out of the atmosphere that we've been dumping into it for
right.
all this time?
Yeah.
You know, like I said, general silviculture, I think, you know, thinning the forest and so that the trees have more resources to grow faster. Mm-hmm. That's kind of one of the projects that we're working on mm-hmm. up in the Soquel Demonstration State Forest is, you know, how quickly does it actually happen?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a question.
Yeah.
We don't really know.
How do you measure it?
Well, we basically put in a plot, mm-hmm. just like we do here,
mm-hmm.
And you measure everything, and then they treat it, they thin it however they're going to thin it,
mm-hmm.
we measure it again, and then you wait.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then you compare that to a plot that wasn't treated and see if the trees actually are growing faster. And
right.
you can measure, like, actually the actual mass of all the trees
right.
in the same area,
yeah.
and are we actually getting more?
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that we want to find out. You know, we're actually going to have some answers soon. You know, this year we're going back to two other treatment sites. One is in Marin, on the Marin Municipal Water District.
Mm-hmm.
They were doing the restoration. So that, like I was mentioning, the disease was just in this cyclical, like trees resprouting, getting the disease again. And so they went in and actually removed tan oak.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The resprouting tan oaks and leaving anything that was still healthy, and mostly that was redwood.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're going to go back. It's going to be 10 years since we did that. Mm-hmm. And then the other project is up in Humboldt County, right outside the Hoopa territory up there.
Mm-hmm.
We on Bureau of Land Management property, they just got the disease. They just got the pathogen there mm-hmm. recently. And so they wanted to thin the forest of tan oak to try to see if they can prevent transmission from happening faster.
Mm-hmm.
And so that too is another project. We're going to go remeasure those. It's going to have been 10 years.
Wow.
To see, like, are these trees actually growing faster?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, we'll see.
Yeah, and so a lot of this is kind of chasing the bad news in a way, because there are so many negative things that are apparently happening in our landscape, and these pathogens, and of course, climate change overriding all of that. Are there, just kind of a silly question perhaps, but are there times when you've had results from some research project that have been surprisingly positive? Like, wow.
Well, that, you know, that fewer trees survive, I was immediately like, oh no. And it's like, well.
Right, maybe.
You know, people talk about the forest being overstocked and, you know, and so I don't know. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't know that was definitely... I felt like that was somewhat positive,
right.
you know,
yeah.
But I deal with a lot of negative, I deal with a lot of sad, you know, there was one time at the Jade Festival that somebody introduced me as the Oak Death Girl. And I was just like, oh no. Oh, that's fine.
That's fine.
Oh, it's kind of sad, you know, but I don't know. Part of it is...
You've been the Oak Death Girl for 17 years.
Oh, more, right?
More,
since
even.
2001.
Right. Yes. Right.
Yeah, I mean, I have been working on this pathogen since 2000. And
right.
And that, you know, I guess that's I'm glad. I like it's good. I'm actually an expert in something.
Yes.
And I don't. I don't necessarily have. I don't have an advanced degree, right?
Right.
So I just have an undergraduate degree.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of some people call me doctor, and I'm just I'll take it for a little. No, it's just I basically have learned on the job.
But you could have done had you.
Oh.
Obviously.
Yeah.
This could have been a thesis for sure.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. And in fact, my job, to do what I do, you would have to have an advanced degree.
Right.
But somebody, again, I give a lot of credit to my boss, Dave Rizzo, because he's had the confidence in me to give me the responsibility that you would need an advanced degree to do. And,
right.
and not just him, but the other people that I work with,
And that really leads me to the question then, and in terms of conceiving of and designing these research projects, how does that work? How much of that, obviously you do, some or a lot of that, but talk about that for a second. What's the genesis of the project, and who decides?
It's a collaborative thing. I mean, I'm the boots on the ground.
Yeah.
Right. So, when somebody comes, especially like master's or PhD students come and they want to answer a question, they do typically ask me, is this feasible? Does this make sense? Even as it comes to results too. And I'm fortunate that the people I've worked with, mainly through Dave's mentorship, have included me on authorships, and included me in analysis. And, I don't do statistical analysis, but I understand the results.
Mm-hmm.
I understand what they say and can help them make sense of what the results are saying.
Mm-hmm.
So, but as far as like, project design, the way that the plots are set up has
and also I think I'm sorry, but also the overall or the questions. I mean, obviously you are designing this in order to respond to certain questions that you have.
Yeah,
and those questions.
Those questions are born of our group discussion.
Yep.
I mean. Nina coming in with the ceanothus, I was just thrilled, that somebody cared about ceanothus, because it's obviously a very major component of what we have going on here.
Yeah.
And so, it's her her leadership in her experience with other nitrogen fixating plants around the world that comes and looks at the system and is interested, and she comes out and we did this really fun project where we went around to as many different age fires as I could in a week's time, and we dug up ceanothus and measured their biomass
all over the state.
No, just here.
Okay.
Just here. And that project, that like 1 week of fieldwork is fueling our work, is basically, it's like, that was kind of a reconnaissance.
Yeah.
We looked at ceanothus that burned in 1985. Fainer at Big Creek was able to use a tractor and pull one up, and we collected the entire individual to measure its biomass.
Yeah.
I mean, it was amazing.
Yeah.
And then she was measuring how quickly the nodules fixate nitrogen. She had fancy contraptions, and we did that in multiple different locations. And so, that's how it's born. And so now it's like, at this point, it's more about, there's not more experiments necessarily. It's more about like, what can we learn from the data? There's so many questions, 17 years of data.
And they come up as you go along, of course.
We'll never
exhaust
all the questions.
Right.
We are actually waiting to hear from a National Science Foundation grant right now.
Mm-hmm.
We submitted it in December, and we hope to hear by June. And that one is mostly ceanothus focused, and really it's kind of a common garden experiment. We have nutrient analysis from the soil in our plot, but to be absolutely sure we are seeing what we're seeing, you kind of need to do like an outplanting and subject it to known amounts of nitrogen and phosphorus, and shade some and leave some out in the sun. And so that's what we hope to do in the next 3 to 5 years.
And that's described in this grant application?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Wow, good luck.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, yeah. I mean, hopefully we'll hear.
Yeah, yeah. What about in our immediate, landscape here, where we are now? What plants are we surrounded by here?
We are fortunate to still have some black oaks, mm-hmm. although they're all dying. They are just climax here.
I can see.
And we have this native pathogen called armillaria, honey mushrooms. Uh-huh. It's a root rot pathogen. Uh-uh. And I don't really know why it's so prevalent here, but they hadn't burned here in over 100 years.
Right.
And so maybe that has something to do with it. But what it does do is it persists in the environment so that seedlings don't survive.
Right.
And so we have all these very mature hanging on these black oaks that are, and there's no little guys.
Mm-hmm.
But you just go over on Skinner Ridge over there and there's plenty of them.
Okay.
So, but so there's black oak, we have coleslive oak, shrieve oak, and madrone here. Not a lot of bay, but those are the main trees that we have up here. You know, we have toyon, and of course the springtime, the death camas are my favorite. They're all starting to come up.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah.
So. What about the bay? Is it true that the bay is a carrier?
Oh, the bay is the most important driver of the disease.
Right. Yeah.
Time and time again, everywhere throughout all of everyone's research. If
right.
there's bay, it means it's going to be worse.
Clear correlation. Yeah.
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 Yeah. So we have like the north side of our property, the north facing side, we have a pure tan oak stand that didn't really have that much disease. And it was just pure tan oak. We're higher elevation. It's a little drier, but there's also no bay.
Mm-hmm.
But it just got destroyed this winter.
Oh, because of the what?
Because of the wind. I mean, we just got rocked.
Oh.
We got rocked by this year's winter.
What kind of wind speeds did you have?
Well, they clocked 89 at the Brazil Ranch.
Yeah.
And my anemometer, I think it moved. I saw it like moving, but I got like, I think I got 67.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it was also, the big winds were coming from the northeast.
Uh-huh.
And so it's blocked. But my anemometer is right on the other side of the
right,
thermometer.
Right, right.
Because usually it's from the south, so I put it over there.
Yeah,
anyway.
Yeah.
Right, anyway, right, but yeah, so like, I don't have a perfect weather system, but I am a weather nut. I mean, I look at all the different stations. I look at the weather 2-3 times a day
right.
throughout the whole year.
Oh, you mean online? Mm-hmm. Monitoring the stations?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because, I mean, well, I have to. Well, you know, if you're... You know, I was a volunteer firefighter for 9 years.
Yeah.
And if you learn anything about being in the fire, it's watching the weather.
Yeah. Yeah.
Looking at the weather.
Yeah.
What's it gonna do? Like, you know, even though I'm not in it anymore, just going out into the field, like, what's it gonna do? Is mm-hmm. it gonna be extra hot today? Maybe we wanna be at a lower elevation, you know?
Sure. Yeah.
It's gonna be cool today, let's go up,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of thing. But mm-hmm. But yeah, and then the winter time, it's like, okay, when do we have to like remove all the vehicles? Because like these black oaks are all going, so we can't have any vehicles near any of the trees,
right.
any of the black oaks.
Initially back in 2000, back in the early days of you being here, what came first? Big Sur?
Yeah.
Or people or plants? Or why did you end up here? What was the initial draw?
Well, back in 2000, we divided the state into three.
Again, who are we there?
With the Wildlife Conservation
yep,
Society.
Right, yep.
We were just basically going throughout the range of tan oak.
Yep.
And I just happened to get the southern portion, which is Santa Barbara to Santa Cruz.
Yep.
And then there was a middle section and a northern section. And I was crew leader of that group. And so this was my stomping ground. I was basically told to go and find all the tan oaks I could.
In the whole of Big Sur?
Well, not all of Big Sur. We did a lot of roadside
sure,
surveys,
sure.
you
yeah,
know,
yeah.
But also down south and stuff. So,
mm-hmm.
and then after that, you know, we didn't have funding to do this anymore. And I still worked for the Wildlife Conservation Society up in the very northeast corner of Oregon. After that, I decided I didn't want to go back to Boston anymore. And I decided I was working with a bunch of people from Humboldt State University. Mm-hmm. And so I was so impressed with the education they had gotten. I was like, okay, great. I'm going to go get my residency in California, and then I'm going to go get my master's at HSU. Mm-hmm. And so I moved to Arcata, and I lived there. I worked at a juice bar for a year and a half. And then funding came through to work at Big Sur. So they were like, come on down. I said, okay. And my first introduction was pulling into Big Creek, meeting Fainer and John Smiley, mm-hmm. who shook hands like they hadn't seen each other in a couple of weeks, which I thought was hilarious.
Yeah.
And then they loaded us up in the back of the flatbed truck and drove me down to Whale Point.
Oh.
And I was giddy.
Yeah,
I mean,
course.
I don't know that there's only been a couple of times in my life that I could actually say, like, I was just shivering with laughter and excitement, you know, because they had just said, this is where you're going to be for the next year.
Right.
And I was like, oh, my God, I have died and gone to heaven.
Yeah.
So then I lived at Big Creek.
Did you end up hearing whales?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yes. Yes. One of the most fantastic things is sitting in hot water and listening to whales breathe.
Yeah.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, really cool. Yeah. I lived at Big Creek for a while until I got my own place, you know, working, doing the acorn surveys. Mm-hmm. And then I moved on to Clear Ridge and I almost moved up to Partington. There was a trailer on Sula's property that was just overrun with wood rats.
Like, and wood rats are your favorites?
Oh my God. And so I spent like an entire week like cleaning and shoveling and getting it, you know, trying to clean it out. And at the end I was like, I can't do this. And then the house came available on Clear Ridge. I moved up to Clear Ridge and then when funding ended, I didn't know what I was going to do. So I worked at the campground at Ventana for a little while. And then I went to Costa Rica and I studied bee diversity. And then I went to Alaska and worked up in the oil fields for a summer. Mm-hmm. And then I came back.
Oil fields north of the Brooks Range? I mean, on the Arctic?
Yeah, the North Slope.
Yeah, North Slope. Okay.
Yeah, in Prudhoe Bay. Mm-hmm. Really interesting.
Yeah.
Really, really an amazing opportunity to be out on the tundra.
Right.
With the facilities of the oil fields. I was on the British Petroleum oil fields. They keep a tight ship. Mm-hmm. I was impressed with what they're not a speck of trash anywhere. nobody's allowed onto those oil, like out into the tundra.
Right.
All the guys that were there, you know, we stuck out like sore thumbs, you know. two young women there, our faces blasting red because we're the only ones outside. Mm-hmm. And those guys, all they wanted to know was about the animals. You know, they were actually genuinely really, really interested.
So this, in a way, this meant that it was very pristine.
Because
it almost that whole area is pristine, of course. But
yeah, but I mean, they do their best as mm-hmm. well. You know, obviously the oil infrastructure is massive, massive infrastructure, and they do. You know, but we all use oil, and it's an extremely productive part of the world. And so, you know, like I said, I feel really privileged to be able to have spent time there and see all the interactions with all the different animals up there. Yeah. And when the caribou start coming, and then all of a sudden one day they are there, and there's tens of thousands of caribou in every single direction, and just amazing.
Wow.
Really cool. But why else? Like, nobody, you don't just go to visit the tundra.
Right, right.
You know what I mean? Like, you have to, like, be there to, mm-hmm. like, you know, see the Arctic fox and the geese and the musk oxen. It's just, like, really, really awesome.
Wow.
Really, really. That's definitely a highlight. In Costa Rica, too, was pretty amazing. Yeah. Bee diversity was something I never worked with insects before.
Mm-hmm.
So that was pretty cool.
This is native bee, wild bee diversity.
Yeah, so Costa Rica doesn't allow you to remove forest around waterways. And so at the time, this was in 2005, the World Health Organization had just recently gave Vietnam lot of money to improve their coffee plantations, mm-hmm. to give them some economy. And in turn, it kind of destroyed the coffee industry quite a bit in Costa Rica. And so a lot of them were cutting down their coffee plantations in exchange for rangeland.
It's because of the price drop.
Yeah, because of the price drop. Yeah. And so what we were doing was going to different size fields and that were adjacent to different size forests that were preserved, and trying to see if a bigger, what size forest was optimal to keep bee diversity up. And the way it ties in with coffee is that coffee is self-pollinated, but when there's greater bee diversity, you have a much greater yield. Mm-hmm. So really cool project that I was on the third year of that project, and the bee diversity never plateaued. Never plateaued. Mm-hmm. And I found a new bee to science.
You did?
I did, yep. I mean, of course, I didn't describe it or anything, but I did catch it, and I did show it to my boss.
Is it named after you?
No. No, it's named after the Wilson Botanical Gardens.
Okay.
Where I caught it. But it was like, that was always one of my lifelong goals, is to discover something new.
Yeah,
and
of course.
I'm like, okay, check. Good enough.
Congratulations. That's great.
Yeah, it's pretty good. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so that was really cool to look at bees like mm-hmm, that. Mm-hmm. And so I have an appreciation.
Carrie, we can talk forever, I think. And I have one more thing before I'm going to ask you sort of a general thing. But living here that you are now, first of all, I presume that the Big Sur landscape and the fantastic amount of bio sort of regional diversity in Big Sur is kind of stunning, right?
Yeah.
And you know that the way that the climate changes from the maritime up into the alpine and so on, and all of that must be exciting to you or stimulating for you.
Yeah.
So you're happy to be in Big Sur? I can.
I am.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm going to ask you then this, because you live more exposed and more intimately connected to the wild part of Big Sur, let's say. You have here, where you are, you have tremendous, well, maybe not, you're fairly close to the maritime influence because of the canyons or the way it's the landscape shapes where you are. What I'm fishing for is that you get quite a bit of fluctuation in temperature up here.
Oh, yeah.
Because of your elevation.
Oh, yeah. So it can snow, but it also just cooks
up here, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So overall, how do you like it up here?
Well, you know, so like, I mean, I like ridge living, mm-hmm. right? I've lived like on Clear Ridge, you know, and I've lived in the Redwoods, at Lower Palo, and I lived at Big Creek and stuff. They all have their positives and negatives. We're self-sufficient.
Yeah.
We know how to be here for months at a time. No problem.
Right,
you know,
right.
Especially now with the satellite internet, we're good. You know. So,
yeah.
But the summers are hard.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And then fires too. You know, I mean, it's hard. People are like, oh, you're so lucky to live in Big Sur. And it's like, hard to live in Big Sur.
Right.
I mean, of course, the way that we do.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Very different than people who live in the more temperate climate.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I always thought that, like, if I had a choice, like if you were like, okay, you could live
anywhere,
I'd say that the 1 to 1200 feet is where it's at, because you're out of the fog. You know, but you get that influence in the summer. Yep.
And you're beneath the insects.
Yeah. That's like the sweet spot, you know.
Yeah.
But you don't get black oak, and you don't get as much madrone, and you hardly get snow.
Right.
You know, we get snow every year.
Right.
I don't know. I can't be unhappy.
No.
You know, I mean, like, it, I think the hardest part really is fire season.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's the biggest challenge. It's, you know, it's fire season year round. Like I'm constantly thinking about fire, you know, like, okay, the wintertime, okay, it's time to burn. It's time to clean up. In the summertime, I'm raking everything and I have chickens. So it's like helping me. I compost everything, you know?
Yeah.
So that's the mm-hmm. that's the hardest
But you also enjoy here, you get such an intimate connection with the landscape, because it is, except for this airplane, right, just at this moment, but it is quiet.
Yeah.
It is very, you're very near the undisturbed, relatively undisturbed landscape, and very solitary.
Yeah.
And you must be a person that can, first of all, take that, and secondly, and enjoy it.
Yeah. I mean, people say, like, oh, isn't it lonely? I'm like, absolutely not. No. You know, we see people.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like we don't see people.
Right.
You know, I consider myself a pretty social person, you know?
Yeah.
Even though I live way out in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
You know, like...
But like I said in my email to you just recently, I haven't even seen you at Safeway lately.
Yeah. No, I mean, we go to town once a week, maybe.
Yeah. Same for me, actually.
I mean, you know, we don't necessarily even have to, you know.
Right.
I mean, I have enough food up here. Somebody asked me, you have food? I'm like, oh, yeah, I've got a lot of food.
Yeah.
You know, I remember during the pandemic, we took, you know, stock of, like, what we had. You know, we were like, okay, now what do we have? I still have it in my little notebook, you know, like, what did we have? We had quite a bit of food at that time, and, you know, we've kind of upped the game a little bit.
Yeah. But do you have a lettuce patch somewhere?
I do. We have down there, there's a solar hot self-circulating bath down there.
Nice.
And then we have a couple troughs with
some vegetables.
Vegetables. Yeah.
Nice.
Not a lot.
How do you do, what about water?
We have a spring.
Uh-huh. Gravity?
Gravity. No, the system that we have right now, we have a high lifter for it.
Okay, okay.
Yeah, we used to have a gravity system, but it's from the other side of the property, and we never repaired it since the fire.
Right, so the high lifter is good enough.
High lifter is pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Takes a little bit of maintenance, but sort of the gravity one. And yeah, I mean, the world changed after the fire, for us. Like, you know, I was just looking at some old pictures.
So what else did you think about when we decided to have this chat, you and I, which is, of course, to share with people this extraordinary thing that you have done and your life? It's so fascinating. What else did you think would be interesting to share, or what did you think that we were going to talk about?
I thought we were going to talk about this and talk about what kind of work I'm doing, mm-hmm. and what it's like to live here. I mean, I think, I don't know who listens to your podcast, but probably a lot of people who live here, everybody has their own experience of being here and stuff, and the challenges, and I don't know. I mean, I guess, you know, this was originally started because of the land use plan, and which I feel like I'm just kind of starting to be involved with a little bit. Mm-hmm. I wasn't gonna get involved with this, mainly because sometimes different groups I've been participating in a lot of different groups over the years, and a little frustrated with not seeing them go anywhere.
Yeah.
And also I just really busy, I've stepped back majorly from a lot of community things that I've done ever since the fire, because I just don't have time.
Right.
You know, I mean,
right.
Life is hard enough to get your feet back on your ground. I mean, we're still reeling from, from the fire, but the land use plan is important,
mm-hmm.
I can't help but be a little skeptical, only because if you read the old one, there's so many violations in it already.
Yeah. Violations of it.
Of it.
Yeah.
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 But you can only try, I guess.
Yes.
You know, I mentioned that at the last meeting because Martha Deal was saying, no, this is state law.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be observed by all the different agencies. And I don't want to be negative on the land use plan because it's obviously really important.
Mm-hmm.
And I do hope that some of the things in there will be upheld.
Right. Why do you think, well, it is important, you said.
develop that just a bit. Why is it important, do you think?
Oh, I mean, it's what's made Big Sur what it is now, you know, protecting what we have to, for future generations. I mean, you know, all of the you know, what is it, visitor management planning, that that really needs to be in there. You know, we obviously are having problems here on the coast with too many people, and you know, how do we do it right? You know, how do we protect what we have? Because it's getting pretty beat up.
You know?
I mean, I haven't been here that long. And to see
the diminished quality of experience for a lot of people too.
I mean, for all of us, you know. I mean, I definitely check myself a lot. You know, like I don't want to. Because I've seen some people, some, you know, you see all kinds of nasty things online. People call locals, you know, that they just want to keep it for themselves, and you know, and they don't want to share it with anybody, and that it's this privilege, blah blah blah, and I check myself on that. You know, it's not about that. You know, like I definitely don't complain that much about traffic. Like even if it bothers me, I don't complain anymore. You know, fine. I do think that the speed limit should be less on the highway, especially in some of the more busy areas. But it's not really about that. It's about the trash. It's about the human waste. It's about the invasive species. It's like, it's really not that nice. It's horrible. You avoid the highway like the plague on a weekend in the summer, right? You're not going to go there.
Right.
You got to stay away.
Yeah.
Because it's just not great.
No. And we are obviously faced with, I think, inevitably, or it's like the day will come when we are having, there are several sort of canaries in the coal mine already. Look at the traffic jam at Boronda Trail now. I mean, at the Partington Cove, this is in my neighborhood.
Yeah.
How, and of course, not to mention, Los Lobos up here.
Oh yeah,
and so on. Right. I mean, there are these little clusters, and we are saying this, and we've been saying this.
Yeah.
But now, even with the road closed in the month of March.
Yeah.
So I think that we're getting very close to the day when, in fact, it will happen that we have a massive gridlock on Highway 1, which could become a public hazard, number one, or all kinds of ramifications.
Yeah.
And I think that's when stakeholders are going to have to sit down and say, that day will come. I think it'll come before you and I are out of here. I think it'll happen in our lifetime.
Well, I mean, it kind of has, Magnus. I mean, there's been, I don't know how many times there's been, like, when, you know, the listserv here, we have a neighborhood listserv in Palo, Colorado.
Yeah.
And people will send things to the listserv, you know, traffic backed up to Sobranes. Traffic to from Carmel to Palo, Colorado. Traffic backed up to the Bixby Bridge from Rio Road.
There you go.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's, think about like how, if you were visiting here, and you got stuck in that traffic. So instead of getting back and having dinner, you're waiting in traffic for an hour and a half.
Yeah.
That's.
Yeah. Let me make just one political statement, or a wish, I suppose. But I watched something on television the other day, and I don't recall. Could have been a sporting event. I don't know. But it was national television. It wasn't your local channel.
Okay.
And suddenly this advertising came on.
Oh,
from,
no.
No, but from Monterey County.
Okay.
And it was a shot of the classic shot from Pebble, and then the shot of Bixby.
No.
And
recently?
Yes.
Wow, because they very explicitly say they don't display the Bixby Bridge anymore.
Well, then they are. I mean, then I caveat. I may have exaggerated that part. It could have been Big Creek. It could have been, some other coastal shot.
Uh-huh.
Maybe not Bixby, but unquestioningly they were featuring Big Sur and Pebble, the most sort of beautiful vistas, and saying Monterey County welcomes you or something like that.
Right, right.
And I thought to myself, why on earth are we spending taxpayers' money on attracting even more people here. That is not...
Well, because everybody stands to make more money.
Yeah, and it's not creative.
Greed kind of rules the world. It's just so it is.
Yeah, yeah. It's actually surprising to me because every single person pretty much that you speak to that live here or that care about this place, even as visitors, are all in agreement that it would be a very good idea to preserve both the visitor experience and the bioregional health.
Or the
health of the environment, both flora and fauna.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, a lot of things about the land use plan, though, too. I'm just going to say that things are not black and white.
Right.
You know, there's a lot of times when I hear different people's take on things, it's like, well, you know, it's not yes or no. You know, there's got to be, you got to find the middle ground on things. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I don't think that anybody who is living here is trying to say absolutely no tourists, you know. I think that we're trying to find some sort of a healthy balance.
Absolutely.
And making sure that, you know, people are safe and the environment is safe and that you can enjoy it because it's just not the same anymore.
No. You know? And share ideas of share information about what is peculiar, perhaps, in this environment as far as how you behave. I'm always saying that it's a Swedish person or a Canadian person who lives in an environment where fire doesn't exist. So they throw cigarettes out the window.
Yeah.
And, you know, that kind of consciousness is not necessarily there with all the visitors.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Behavior sort of... I don't know, we've always talked about that, having like a brochure or something, but I think that should also be improved on, perhaps, the online presence as far as that kind of information.
Yeah. I mean, I'm total, do not use social media at all.
Right. But people do. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Now you can predicate governmental action on the fact that people have social media. So it's no longer that you have to make special accommodations because now it's expected. I mean, you can hardly travel, for instance, without it now. What else do you want to talk about?
I don't know. Yeah, I think...
That's one more question regarding your research and your work. I have not heard or seen a lot of discussion about sudden oak death. It sort of have diminished in its
attention.
Right?
Yeah. Well, you know, part of it is because of the fires.
Yeah.
So where it has burned, we don't have as much disease.
Right.
The pathogen is there. Mm-hmm. Don't get me wrong. So there's a difference between the presence of the pathogen and disease. When we talk about it, it's like the pathogen can be there, but the disease of actually dead, dying trees
from it.
So we don't. So just now, we went back to a bunch of plots that last burned in 2008, last year, and just now we're starting to see disease in a lot of those. Mm-hmm. But in the areas that burned in 2016 and definitely in 2020. You know, we're not seeing disease.
Right.
However, if you go south of Paulslide into the quote unquote unburned zone, right? You know, I mean, obviously they've had their share of fires, but not in recent history.
Right.
Willow Creek is crazy right now. Willow Creek would remind you of Partington in the early 2000s right now.
Wow.
It is crazy.
Wow.
Standing dead trees everywhere.
Wow.
So Willow Creek and Plaskett are really getting hammered now. Mm-hmm. You know, they're obviously a decade behind us, behind the northern section, but they, you know, so they are dealing with it. It's a really bad situation down there right now.
Wow.
As far as sudden oak death goes.
Hmm.
So it's still there.
So it took that time.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, it has, and it's still taking its time going south. So it's still technically not in San Luis Obispo County yet.
Wow.
They were able to retrieve it from the San Capoforo, from the creek itself, from the water, but they've never been able to find it terrestrially. So because
which
of,
is good, of course, which is good. Last, yeah.
Well, the whole Hearst, you know, that whole San Simeon, that's kind of a natural barrier. Mm-hmm. But you know, there are pockets in San Luis Obispo where it could be, you could see some disease. Mm-hmm. You know, as you go north and through Santa Cruz, through Marin, up into Mendocino. Now, once you get up into Mendocino, you're starting to see new disease up there, and up in Humboldt. Mm. So it is still happening. Mm. It's just for our local area. You know, we've had it bad for a long time.
Yeah, you get sort of inured to it in a way. I mean, just so that's another thing we live with.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm always amazed when somebody's like, "Oh, I don't know much about it." Mm. You're like, "Oh, really? Whoa, I'm not doing my job then." You know, no, like, wow.
Actually, that was the follow-up question: how much time do you spend thinking about the public relations aspect?
Well, that's another really good part of my job. So. Mm-hmm. The National Science Foundation requires that you have a public outreach, broader impacts is what they call it.
Yeah.
So, you know, how do you plan on giving back? Mm-hmm. You know, how do you plan on giving this back to the public? Because the public are the people who pay for this research.
Right.
And so that's been part of my job since the beginning.
Yeah.
Is to disseminate information to the public. And I love it. Mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, I know a lot of scientists don't. And I think part of that is that they don't have the opportunity because they're, you know, an academic, you know, you're in school, you're getting your PhD, you're going to your site, you're getting your stuff, and then you're going somewhere else to get your job.
Yeah.
You know, like you don't have that time you don't have that luxury to like spend time with the public in which you're working. Mm-hmm. So I have been given that as part of my job.
Yeah.
And
that manifests in ways like giving talks, talking to me.
Talking to people at mailboxes. I mean, wherever it may be, I'm always talking about it. I live and breathe this. It's definitely my life.
Yeah.
You know? And I'm not unhappy about that.
So you are the sudden
I am the oak tip girl.
Oak tip girl. Yeah.
I mean, I like I said, I enjoy talking to the public.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
I try to instill that in the people who work for me, the young people that come around the college. I tell them that, you know, when we encounter a local landowner or somebody, I'm going to spend some time talking to people because one, I like it. Mm-hmm. You know, now, especially that I'm part of the community, like most people know me,
right.
And I enjoy hearing what people have to say and genuinely care and can relate. Mm-hmm. You know, we lost trees. I understand. Yeah. I love the trees, and my heart goes out to people who are like, but this one tree, you know, how do I do? You know, how can I help and all that stuff?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And they see something interesting. You know, I have people who. And the community just send me natural observations,
yeah,
like random stuff, and I love that. Mm-hmm. I love that people are like, oh, we thought you'd be interested. I am interested in that.
Yeah,
so please, yeah, I love to share that those kinds of things.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's all kinds of mysteries all around us.
Of course,
I mean, and I don't know all of them. That is for sure. So, but I really, you know, I really do enjoy learning more. You know, when I did want to put my toothbrush somewhere, I wanted to, you know, study what I call the interannual variability, not just learn a new system, but see that when the death cam has come up a little bit early, or, oh, the hound's tongue didn't come up this year, or it's a little bit late, or, oh, did you ever see it when, have you ever seen it when the madrones just exude sap? I still don't. I've seen it twice, and I think it's like extreme drought or something, or fire induced. I'm not really sure, but then the sap is really yummy too. Mm-hmm. But you know, right now we have this new thing going on with these. You know, our trees are so bare. There's this gall. There's this little. It's a two-horned gall that's on the bottom side of these coastline oaks, and it's just totally denuded them.
It eats the leaves.
It doesn't eat the leaves. It basically is on the underside of the leaves, and it causes a little bit of dieback, and
I don't even yeah.
I don't see one on here, but essentially it causes this little bit of dieback, and then and now they're all like falling off. And the way I found this was because I have peacocks.
Uh-huh.
I have a peacock and two peahens. And one day over there by the bike, they were going to town. They were eating something off the ground, and I was over there.
What was it?
And I'm like, what are you eating? Like, they spent the whole day right in that one spot, and they never do this.
Right.
And I was like, what is it? And I come to find out the galls were falling off the leaves and they were just gorging themselves. So this winter, oh, here's one. That's a little tiny gall right there.
Yeah. Okay.
And that gall is basically tapped into the vein of these leaves and is causing some dieback. And so the oaks are shedding the leaves, some of the individuals, but not all of them. And I'm just like, I'm just waiting because look at all the buds. It's going to be a beautiful spring. All the buds on the ends of the trees, they're going to just explode with new growth.
And
so maybe it's a good thing.
Yeah.
You know, like this is the world of pathogens, you know. You know, pathogens, they do some damage, but in the end, the trees may be stronger because of it. It's a little bit different with a non-native pathogen, obviously. With sudden oak death, I am constantly reminding myself of that, you know, that this pathogen is here because of humans. And and that's kind of what has kept me going with it, is that it's not just a disease. It's a human-caused disease.
Right.
And that's why I feel like it's
And how did it happen?
Through the nursery trade, specifically rhododendrons.
Right.
Yeah.
Imported.
Yeah. And so that's one thing that you can do. They are starting to have this accreditation program where nurseries can sign up and basically get tested to make sure that they are not inadvertently spreading other pathogens and have some sort of a accreditation. So it's something that you can ask for from your nurseries, which I think is amazing. But in lieu of that, if you do buy things from the nursery, you can just self-quarantine them. So buy a plant and don't plant it right away.
Right.
Keep it alive, you know, put it in a good spot, keep it watered, but wait about a month. And if it starts to develop symptoms, then bring it back. Because you never know.
How do you keep your peacock safe from the lions?
Peacocks are amazingly independent and resilient.
Wow.
They do their thing.
They'll scare the lions away.
Yeah, they do. They roost in this black oak up here, like way up in the black oak.
Poor guys.
And when it's windy and stuff, you see them blowing. And it's like, oh my gosh. But all three of them were born here, and you know, there's no doubt we have lost some. But they're pretty
smart.
We hardly have to feed them. They're free roaming.
Right.
They're hanging out with the chickens probably right now.
Yeah.
And yeah, they do it. They are amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, I know peacocks and peafowl in general have a bad rap because they're noisy as all can be. And then they get to be out of control. They have like population problems.
Yeah.
So we lock them up during the breeding time.
Yeah.
I mean, they have a nice pen and stuff like that.
Right,
but they're, you know, they do their thing and they're protected. Because otherwise the hens would get eaten.
Yeah.
Right? And as they bed down to sit on eggs. So, and then we eat the eggs so we don't have too many.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
God, what a view you have here. That's extraordinary.
Yeah, I know. I mean, you're talking about trails and stuff, and it's like the trail situation in all of Big Sur. You know, that we have this new, we have a new postdoc from the Czech Republic, and he wanted to come down, and he said, "Oh, I'm gonna do. I want to do get to 40 plots this spring." And I was like, "Oh, I don't think so. You know, I don't think that that's a possibility." And you know, the trails are just, there's just not that many anymore, you know. Right. And I don't know, I you know, I sound like an old timer. Back in the day when we set up these plots, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You know, I have before and after photos of these plots.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's just constantly amazing.
Yeah.
And shocking what it used to look like. And so,
do you have anything creative to say about the pampas grass?
Oh, the pampas grass!
Yeah, I mean, I understand that it's a never-ending story, but you know, I'm just curious. What do you say?
So years ago, my husband worked for Big Creek, and at the time, Mark Reedy asked them to do a pampas grass removal project in Big Creek, and they went all over the reserve and they scouted them out with binoculars and stuff and found, they found big, huge clumps of pampas grass way off in the reserve, And they went there and they manually dug them up.
Mechanically removed.
Dug them up.
Yep.
Pickaxe and shovel. And you know, hard work.
Yes.
Of course my husband loved it because he got to explore all of Big Creek.
Right.
But and amazing to see how far inland they went.
Yeah.
And Mark was realistic. You don't touch the coastal slope. You know, like, it's just because you're on these, you can't do it.
No.
You know, and I don't know. I personally, I feel like it's a losing battle.
Mm-hmm.
And especially because I know a lot of people are against using herbicide too. And I feel like the best strategy against invasives is to work on the new ones. So Big Creek also has a very detailed invasive species management plan. And their management plan is to focus on the emerging ones. And that the other ones are a kind of a losing game. And I'm sorry to people who disagree with me, but I really think that our time and money is better spent doing other things. I don't like it either.
Right?
You know?
No. And it's just a specter of it. You know, the pampas takes advantage of denuded areas.
Yeah.
Number one.
Yeah.
But not only. It does also spread.
Yeah.
So the specter of it kind of taking over the coast is so bleak.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, there's others too, right? The sticky eupatorium.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
That Gerardina, that has completely replaced the chaparral just south of Nepenthe.
Right.
I cannot believe that.
Right.
I mean, I've been watching that in the middle, I think it's early summer, you see the flowers come out and you realize what you're looking at.
Yeah.
It has replaced chaparral.
Yeah.
And chaparral is supposed to be one of the most resilient ecosystems. Mm. So, you know, when that first started, Big Creek also tried to do a removal, you know, tried to dig some of that stuff up, but it also didn't work. And it's so sad to see those creeks, those waterfalls that no longer have the maidenhair ferns and the boykinia and stuff just hanging in the bubbling mossy covered rocks, and it's just like all a Gerardina. I I refrain from telling my field crew about that when I when they're like, oh, look at how beautiful that is. I'm just like, just shut up, Carrie. Let them enjoy it, you know?
We had a board meeting many, many years ago, and a new landowner came, the road and water company in our neighborhood. And he put his foot way in his mouth because he did exactly that. He said, oh, I love that hillside beneath my house with all those beautiful
white flowers.
Yeah. It was all Scott Froom, of course.
Yeah, But, you know, that being said, you know, there... A whole bunch of Denisa came in here after the fire. Yep. And we had been working on trying to eradicate it. But this whole area that's all clear out in front of the dome over here, that was all Denisa. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And we cut it down and we burned it and it went away.
Yep.
But it's just, there's a line of it.
Still up there.
Still up there. Yep. And we continue to try to pull it here.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean... We don't like it either, right. You know, and you can see it just lines Palo Colorado up and down, and it's just like going over into our property and, you know.
Locally, it works. I mean, you know, if you have a neighborhood association that puts an effort in, it can work in a local area.
Yes.
Partington does not a great job, but a decent job.
You try.
Yeah, we try and keep it away from certain areas.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that's all you can do. And with pampas grass, it's not just Big Sur. I mean, it goes all the way up into Oregon, you know? It's like, I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
I appreciate people's enthusiasm with it, but I really do think that our time is better spent on other things.
Other things.
You know, there's a few years ago, there's this feather grass. Uh-huh. And that is all over now by Grimes Point. Mm-hmm. And it looks like a beautiful bunch grass, you know.
But
it has completely taken over those limestone cliffs. Mm-hmm. I mean, it looks like a native because it's a bunch grass, but it's not. And so, you know, it's kind of hard. I don't know.
You must have amazing moonrise.
Yeah, sometimes this is Uncle Sam. Sometimes it comes right up through the window.
Right.
And that is something.
Yeah.
That is something.
Yeah. Just a little opposing curve coming up.
Yeah, the tooth, right?
Right.
And then that's the window, right?
Yep.
That's what the National Forest is named after.
Right.
The Ventana. I mean, people say that that was once an arch there.
Oh, that's what they think? It's possible?
That's what people say. Yeah. My husband definitely believes that it was like that. And I always look at him like, I want a geologist to tell me that there was actually a keyhole there.
Oh.
It's kind of a running joke.
That's a good vision though.
Yeah, that would be something. And you know, that's all Santa Lucia firs up there.
Yeah.
That's a pure stand of Santa Lucia firs facing us right now.
Yeah.
So I know. And then Pico Blanco too is a magical mountain there. Mm.
All right. Thanks, Carrie.
Yeah. Thank you. Glad that you could come up.
Yeah. I'm so glad we ended up doing this instead of sitting on the side of the road somewhere. So shall we do the same thing in reverse?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, we'll just go down. And, let me just grab my keys. Oh, I'm just going to bring my bag.
Where do I turn around best?
Well, what elevation are you at?
Right now at 1,000.
1,000?
1,000.
Oh, yeah, you're at the sweet spot.
I sometimes, in the summertime, or actually almost any time of year, but sometimes I sort of laugh at how incredibly perfect it is in that amazing, like we talked about, you know, the fog. Sorry, but look at this.
I know.
Landscape. It's like...
It's crazy.
Yeah, it's kind of scary looking.
Oh, it's totally scary.
Yeah.
But I allow myself no more than one climate article.
Right.
A day.
Yeah, right.
I mean, or a week. Sometimes it's just like one a week. I can't.
Meanwhile, you live in the remarkable place.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we live in a remarkable place that is also just, it's rugged.
Yeah.
You know, I think that, you know, a lot of people are like, oh, like I say, you're so lucky to live in Big Sur. And it's like,
yeah,
you know, a lot of times when I interview the young people that want to work, and they're like, oh, I'm so excited to work in Big Sur. I'm like, oh, have you ever been here before? Right. And they're like, yeah. I'm like, have you ever left the highway? Right. You know, and they're like, some of them are like, no. And I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
Then you really haven't been to where we're going to go.
So there's a road cut there, it looks like.
That is the old trail.
Uh-huh.
That's the Skinner Ridge Trail, and it was a road cut up into that corner.
Right.
That's the Skinner Ridge Trail. That's.
And the line of trees that kind of creates a line there.
Mm-hmm.
What is that line?
It's just a north-facing, south-facing line.
Okay.
You know, and
this is not related to fire.
No.
No. Okay.
No, it's not. No. I mean,
there's a water tank down there.
Yep, that's above. That used to serve Botcher's Gap.
Okay.
But it doesn't. That cut that you see just above it is a bad fire line. It's a fire line gone wrong.
Yeah.
They like missed the fire line. You can hardly see the fire line right now. That's amazing.
Yeah.
It basically is just to the left of it going straight up.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes up into that meadow is the fire line.
God, it's gorgeous up there, isn't it?
Yeah, that meadow is pretty great. I mean, the best way to get there right now is to follow that fire line, because the trail doesn't do it for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. But all of those trees up there, I had a colleague come and he's like, what am I looking at? What is that gray stuff? I go, those are trees.
Yeah.
He's like, those are trees? those were black oaks.
Right.
Those are black oaks up there.
And they're dying.
They died in the fire.
Right. That's what I mean.
And they're resprouting.
They are resprouting.
Yeah. When you, like in the fall, it's all yellow.
Yep.
Which brings me happiness that they are there. They're still there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like we just need to not have another fire for a while.
Right.
Another wildfire like this. It's just really, it's too much. But, you know, but I am a proponent of prescribed fire. Mm-hmm. You know, I do believe that one way out of this mess that we have is to burn better, you know, to burn under better conditions,
right?
And to help the forest recover from this by you know, removing some of the dead fuel around here, because unless we can prevent forest fire from happening around here for another 30 years,
right?
I mean. But seeing 2000, you know, it's like, you know, let's go down the numbers here. It's like, you know, just since, you know, like 78, 85, 99, 2008, it's like 2016, 2020. Like, that's not a lot of time between fires.
No.
You know, when I was listening to Hansen and Halley?
Halsey.
Yeah. Halsey, you know. Yeah. I don't think it's black and white.
No.
You know? And like I said, a lot of the research comes from a different ecosystem than this.
Right, right. Is there a little electrical help bike?
Or? Yes, it's an e-bike. Oh, hell yeah. There's no way, Magnus.
I was going to say.
There's no way.
You're such a heroine.
Yeah. No. We recently got those this year. It's my Christmas present.
Nice.
To help us get around the property, you know? Like, we have a quad and stuff, but we have solar, so what are we doing?
Right,
we actually just got an electric car, too, so it's like...
Or you can plug it in on the... You have enough solar?
Yes.
Nice.
We are... Well, we're working on it. Yeah. We're working on upping our solar so that we can... But that's it.
Otherwise, you drive propane up?
For the...
Stove? K-
kitchen?
Kitchen.
Yeah.
For the kitchen. Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. But
you basically drive your tanks up, right? I mean, you have smaller tanks that you just take.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think we have a couple of 20-gallon tanks.
I mean, obviously the guy doesn't drive up your road to fill your tank.
No.
No.
I mean, people do have it here in Palo, but not here.
No.
We've never done it. Here, we can look at this cliff too if you want.
Yes. Yes. Used to.
Maybe. You know, we should just go. Let's just go up to the helipad.
Yeah. I'm going to. Let's see. Where are we now? Not next Saturday, but the following Saturday, I'm flying all the way to India.
Oh, wow. Yes.
I know.
Whoa.
I'm going there for a whole month.
Wow.
To a small region of India that is in the northeast corner. Because when you talk about rhododendron,
yeah.
That's like the native habitat for rhododendron. Yeah.
How excellent.
Yeah.
Wow, a whole month?
Yeah, I know. It's going to be kind of crazy, but I'm taking the opportunity before I fall apart, you know?
Oh, my gosh.
Because <Yeah. laughs> I've had my challenges lately. And
I know. I think the last time we talked, you were just getting your hip replaced.
Exactly, yep.
And I'm assuming that's gone well.
It's gone incredibly well. I wake up every morning being so grateful for that. You know, because it's a whole new lease on life, obviously. I would have been in a wheelchair now.
Wow.
Or, yeah, yeah.
Wow, India.
Yep.
Excellent.
It's right on the border. So it borders Myanmar, where I'm going. Oh. So it's on the east side of Bangladesh.
Okay.
So in that corner. Oh, look at this.
Yeah, so this is this is the helipad. And this is the fire line that goes up.
Yep.
And yeah, this is a big cliff.
This is where I'm start thinking about my hang glider.
Yeah. And you can see that goes all the way down into the Boy Scout camp.
Oh, when I was younger, I would go out there, but I can't.
How big is this?